Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A real-life thriller in the vein of The Devil in the White City, Kate Winkler Dawson's debut, Death in the Air, is a gripping historical narrative of a serial killer, an environmental disaster, and an iconic city struggling to regain its footing. In winter in 1952, London automobiles and thousands of coal-burning hearths belched particulate matter into the air. But the smog that descended on December 5th of 1952 was different. It was a type that held the city hostage for 5 long days. Mass transit ground to a halt, criminals roamed the streets, and 12,000 people died. That same month, there was another killer at large in London, John Reginald Christie, who murdered at least 6 women. In a braided narrative that draws on extensive interviews, never-before-published material, and archival research, Dawson captivatingly recounts the intersecting stories of these two killers and their long-standing impact on modern history. The book that we're featuring this evening is Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city, with my special guest, documentary filmmaker, author, and journalist, Kate Winkler Dawson. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Kate Winkler Dawson.
Thanks, Dan. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible story. Of course, I had not heard anything about the London smog, and I'm sure our audience will be excited to hear this incredible tale, the intersection of two incredible killers, John Reginald Christie and the London smog. I just mentioned that you were a documentary filmmaker. Please tell us about your background in filmmaking before we talk about a little bit about the origins of this book.
Sure. So I've been a journalist for about 25 years or so on television news and television documentaries, and of course now in books. And so, I have a pretty extensive relationship with the press. And so with documentary films, I started making those when I was in college, and throughout my graduate school studies in New York. And then when I went to San Francisco, I lived 2 years in San Francisco, and I made a 2-part documentary with another filmmaker for ABC Nightline. And so I've sort of, when I've worked for different television networks, so Fox News Channel, I've worked for WCBS Television, ABC Network Radio, I've always done both long form and short form journalism projects, and of course those do include documentaries. And so when I was in San Francisco with Fox News Channel, I was assigned to work on the Gary Condit case, which I'm assuming many people in your audience would remember. Dan, do you remember the Gary Condit case from 2001? So I think that was probably the case I've spent the most time on. And, of course, that was a U.S. congressman who's was married and having an affair with his intern, and then she went missing, and he fell under suspicion. And so this was, a pretty deep dive for me into working on a longer project, and also just sort of the day-to-day grind of working for a 24-hour news channel. On really gathering the visuals and the sources for a crime story. And I think that case really got me hooked on true crime and true crime tales. And so that sort of extended I've done, you know, sports documentaries. I've done various. I did the one I did for Nightline was on the rise and fall of dot-coms in San Francisco. So I've you know, as any news producer would, I've had a lot of varying experiences. But true crime is certainly what has interested me the most, which is why I've pursued this in books. So the thing that's interesting, I think, at least about being a documentary producer and television producer, and then turning and pivoting your career to write about these things in books, is of course it's so different. And people ask me, how do you go from, you know, being involved with documentaries and writing these very short sentences for television broadcasts, to then, you know, constructing an entire book that's long form? And I think that I found that my love of documentaries and my love of visuals and my appreciation and understanding of visuals have served me very well, particularly with this book, because it's not easy turning the smog into a boogeyman. And that's what you have to do when you're writing a book. You have to, you know, take this thing, for me, in my case, of course, it was pollution, and describe it in such a way that, you know, somebody should be able to close their eyes and really smell it and feel it and taste it and understand what it feels like to have, you know, smoke particles burn the inside of your throat and you know, all of the sensory things that come with being caught in a 5-day long smog have to come across in the page. And so I think that my work with documentaries really helped me in that sense.
Absolutely. This is incredibly visual, and you have definitely succeeded in conveying that horror and that incredible presence of the smog and devastation. Can you talk about your work on the Texas Board for Actual Innocence? And you mentioned early in your book that also that your father was a criminal defense attorney. Tell us a little bit about this work with the Texas Board for Actual Innocence, and if your father was an influence at all, and how much of an influence as a criminal defense attorney.
Sure. So my father, who was had passed away in 2005. You know, my entire life was a criminal law professor. He was a criminal defense attorney for a short period. And then he went into teaching, and he was a criminal law professor at the University of Texas School of Law, which is one of the best law schools in the country, for 37 years. And he started several different types of clinics for students to come and gain experience, sort of this real life clinical experience. And one of them, before he died, was the what they called the Actual Innocence Clinic. And it was run under a nonprofit that was separate from the university called the Texas Center for Actual Innocence. So my father had this sort of dream of really delving into these cases, these claims from prisoners, which you know, the nonprofit organization received hundreds and then thousands of letters when it really started, of claims of actual innocence from prisoners. And so my dad and I would talk about it quite a lot. And, you know, I grew up talking about law. I've got a couple of cops in my family. I've got a couple of attorneys in my family. And my father and I always debated, you know, law. And he worked particularly in juvenile justice. So he would work to create laws that would help protect privacy for juveniles, but also, you know, kind of create strict guidelines. And so there was always a lot to debate in our house. And when I became a journalist, there was even more to debate. And yeah. So he and I would talk, we would talk quite a lot about, you know, law and order and what's right and what's wrong and what laws are working and what aren't. And so when he started this clinic, I was really intrigued and we talked about it a lot. But unfortunately, when he started the clinic, he was sort of in the downward slide of dying of lung cancer. And so he never lived to see an exoneration, which is what he really wanted to see the most, was the clinic actually and achieve an exoneration. And we ended up achieving two, which was wonderful, but it was after he died. So before he died, he and I talked and he said, you know, I would like you to become involved in the clinic as much as you can. And at this point, I was still living in New York. I was not moved back to Austin, Texas. I was at WCBS in New York. I was teaching full-time at Fordham University. And so I had quite a full life, and, you know, I was making documentaries. But I said, sure, you know, if I end up back in Austin, I'll come and help. And then when he died, I came back to Austin, and I just never left. I wanted to build my life here. And I started teaching at the University of Texas School of Journalism as an adjunct professor. And I spoke to my boss and I said, listen, I think that there is a really good collaboration between the School of Journalism and the actual Innocence Clinic at the law school. I think that I, as a journalist, someone who's teaching other young journalists, I think we can join the young journalists together with the young law school students, and we can all teach together. Because I think that there are many things that journalists can teach law students and lawyers, quite frankly, about how to speak with people, how to interview people. You know, I think people putting people at ease, which sometimes attorneys aren't so great at doing. And so we started this collaboration, and it was really, really positive. There was a case already in the works when I got there. I didn't have anything to do with it except I consulted somewhat on the media aspect of it, but we had an exoneration of two men. A few years after my father died, who were in prison for 12 years for a murder that they didn't commit. And because of our clinic's work, they were released. And so that was it was very bittersweet, I think, for me, because my father would have been thrilled. And this book is very bittersweet for me, because I think I'm very proud of the book the way it is now, but for some reason, I feel like it would have had even more depth had he been alive, and he and I would have really been able to hash things out. Because I know, Dan, you and I talked about this briefly offline, that there are a lot of nuances and intricacies with this case, and it's a wrongful conviction case in the book. And so I think it would have been a very lively, probably year-long discussion with my father had he lived.
Absolutely. Now let's get right to this, because we have so much to cover and it's such a fascinating, complex story. So as you do, you set this story in 1952 in the winter in London, and London being the most populous city in the world at that time. And also you talk about the state of energy at that time, what energy sources there were, and that, of course, was coal. But you talk about the specific type of coal, the coal that wealthier people might use and the coal that the everyday not so wealthy person used. So tell us a little bit about 1952 in the winter and the confluence of events. As you talk about, there had been past environmental type disasters, a fog like this, but this was unique. So tell us about what was happening in the winter of 1952 in London.
Sure. Well, I'll give you a quick little round the world history of London and fuel. So London depended, and the city of London, from its sort of origin in that area, depended on wood for fuel for, of course, hundreds and thousands of years, until the city began to expand and all the woods were being cut down and it became too expensive. So that's the switch to coal. And there were pieces of coal that used to wash up onto the shore of the sea in England, and people would collect them. And it was this really brown, nasty, soft, crumbly coal. And you had to burn four times the amount of coal, of this brown coal, to get the warmth from, you know, a quarter of the amount of black coal. So if we fast forward now to 1952, you have a city that has experienced hundreds of years of smog, because as you said before, it's the world's most populous city. It is the world's most industrialized city at the time. So you have in the area 40, which is an awful lot for a small city like London, 40 coal-fueled power plants pumping out pollution around the clock in a very small space, right, of London. Then you have more than 8 million people burning this cheap coal. So if we're going to keep it very simple, there were two types of coal: the quote unquote clean coal, which we know there's no such thing as clean coal, but the black coal that has the very high carbon content that you can burn, and it, you know, puts off quite a lot of heat and not as much smoke. There's still a lot of toxins. There's still a lot of sulfur dioxide and smoke particles. But compared to the other stuff, the cheap stuff you were referring to was this brown coal that they nicknamed Nutty Slack. It had a very low carbon content, high moisture content, And you had to burn an awful lot of it. And most of it was brown dust with little bits, little nuts of coal. And when it burned, it sort of sparked and smoked and put off very little heat. So you can imagine how much coal, of this brown coal, you had to put onto your fireplace to create warmth, a lot.
Right.
So what happened is this perfect storm in 1952, the first week of 1952, it was the coldest week of the year that they had experienced. And you have more than 8 million people stoking a fire, coal fireplace. And you've got 40 power plants churning out all sorts of particles and pollution. The city had just a few months earlier permanently suspended its electric tram system and replaced it with those beautiful red double-decker buses that people ooh and ah at so much, except they're diesel-fueled. And so there's pollution coming off of that. And so there's this incredible combination of pollution from all these different sources. And here comes, on the 5th of December, a anticyclone, which is a fancy word for a high-pressure system that floats over London and stops right over the city. And this anticyclone creates a lid. It's a weather occurrence, and it creates a lid over the city that traps the air from the ground to this cloud cover and creates a smog. This is pretty common. It's common everywhere. And what happens is when this air is trapped, any pollution that is in the air also becomes trapped. It's really not allowed outside into the atmosphere. All it takes is a little wind, a low pressure system to come in and push away this high pressure system and open the lid. And that normally would happen. It would be, you know, a few hours, or it would be a day or two at the very most, and then the system would go. This one lasted 5 days. No wind, nil on all of the weather reports that I looked at, zero wind for 5 days. So there's a lid over the city, no wind, nowhere to go, and the most polluted city in the world with all of these people burning more and more coal because it's really cold. And so by the end, there were thousands of people who died and continued to die from December of 1952 all the way until March. And that was, I think, a conservative cutoff for sure. I think that probably there were many, many, many for years, people whose lives were shortened or died, you know, within the year. But just to create some sort of a cutoff, the scientists in the government had said, let's, you know, make it this first week of March. So by the end, the government had admitted that 4,000 people died. However, about 40, 50 years later, a group of scientists from Carnegie Mellon suggested and then confirmed that it was an additional 8,000. So a total of 12,000 people died, which made it 4,000, made it, Dan, the world's deadliest air pollution disaster. But of course, 12,000 is a phenomenal number. So it was a crisis that the British government and the British public and the British press never recognized as a crisis.
Incredible. Let's go back to 1949 to 10 Rillington Place and John Reginald Christie's. And he has a place with a garden. So tell us about 10 Rillington Place and also his neighbors, Tim and Beryl. Before we talk about, again, we alluded to this incredible wrongful conviction. Let's talk about these two couples that hung out together next door at 10 Rillington Place.
Sure. I almost want your listeners to grab a piece of paper and a pencil because there's a lot of information about this case, but it's so incredibly fascinating. So, you know, being involved with the Actual Innocence Clinic, I had heard of this case of Timothy Evans and this wrongful conviction and then a wrongful execution. It's one of the most well-known cases, and it's certainly one of the most dramatic. So I went into this considering it to be an investigation, but thinking that, you know, I was going to agree with everyone else, and we'll talk about what everybody else thinks happened a little bit later, and I don't necessarily agree, and I know, Dan, you want to talk a little bit about that. So, let's start with John Reginald Christie, a quiet and assuming man who had a rough go of it early in life, had some major embarrassments with women early on, and it created, you know, a kind of a bitter, angry, resentful man who figured out a way to really get that anger out. And it started really in 1943 with him, when he met a woman in the middle of the war, and he was a war reserve policeman and looked moderately handsome in a uniform. And he carried on an affair with her in Notting Hill. And at the time, Notting Hill was one of the worst areas of London. It's very posh now, but it was a horrible place. And 10 Rillington Place was smack in the middle of Notting Hill. So there was a lot of prostitution, a lot of gambling, a lot of crime, a lot of petty theft, a lot of murders. And the police in Notting Hill particularly were undermanned, overpowered much of the time. And so John Reginald Christie was not such a bad catch as a man in that area. He didn't appear to be sleazy. He didn't appear to be violent. He had money. He offered to pay for drinks. And so he carried on an affair with a woman that he met named Ruth First. And in the middle of having relations, he thought that it would be fun to strangle her. And that's what he did. And I think that triggered him. And he really figured out that this was a method of murder that he enjoyed. And so he buried her in the backyard in 43. And the next year he met another woman named Muriel Eady. And the same thing happened, except he becomes very interesting as a serial killer because of his method, which I've never heard of this before. I was fascinated with William Hare and William Burke, you know, the famous Burkers from Scotland. I'm very interested in cases with, I think, a unique killing style. And what Christie did was, this next woman in 1944, it's really should be noted, because in 1944, he meets Muriel Eady, and she has a cough, kind of an asthmatic cough from the fogs that are happening constantly. And he says, listen, I have a certificate in first aid, which is, you know, very common in the UK to carry, you know, for somebody to be certified in first aid. And right. He says, I can treat you, and I have a cure for that. And just come to my house, and my wife is away. And his wife, Ethel, would frequently visit her sister out of town in Sheffield. And so he would have the flat to himself quite a bit. And he said, come over, I can help you take care of that cough. And so she came over, she trusted him, and she came over, and he sat her down in a chair in the kitchen, and he had a glass jar that he put kind of like almost like a smelling salt, like a balsam fryer, like a perfume. And right. That was in, you know, with this in this jar, and it created a scent, a very small, strong smelling scent. And he had her breathe that in. And at the same time, he had a tube that was connected to his gas cap. So coal gas was being pumped into this glass jar while she was breathing in, you know, this sweet smelling stuff that would have, that she would have thought was calming. She was also breathing in coal gas, which completely disabled her. And, you know, he assaulted her. And then he strangled her with a pair of pantyhose. So he became sort of very good at this MO. And I thought it was an interesting MO, except he didn't do anything for several years. So he took both bodies, he buried them both in the backyard. And he says, and there's no evidence that he killed anyone up until 1949. So in 1949, he and his wife are living in 10 Rillington Place. He is still frequenting prostitutes, which is something he always did. And they're on the ground floor, and a young couple moves in 1949. The man is named Timothy Evans. He's Welsh. And he has a wife named Burl. And they're both, you know, Burl is 19 and Timothy is in his early 20s. And then they have a little girl who is at the time, I think she was about 8 months old or so. And later on, when she made the headlines, she was 13 months older, and her name was Geraldine. And they moved into the top floor and the third floor. of a really narrow, windy staircase up to Rillington Place. And they have a really tumultuous relationship. He drinks a lot. He is violent. He's, I would say, probably your typical abusive husband. He seems like a really good father. Ethel and John Christie don't particularly care for him. They like Burl, and they like the little girl quite a lot. And Ethel actually watches Geraldine when Burl goes out to do some part-time work. But they generally stay out of Timothy Evans' way. They think he's a ruffian. And there are an awful lot of arguments over infidelity. And about a year after they moved in, the Burl and Geraldine go missing, and nobody knows where they are. And at the time, they were the only ones, these two families are the only ones living in the building. So the Christies, who have no children, are on the ground floor, and Tim and Burl and Geraldine are on the top floor, and there's no one in between. There was an elderly man who went into the hospital, and so his flat was empty at the time. So Burl and Geraldine go missing. Timothy Evans, the husband, goes to his home in Wales and spends time with his family there and makes up a few lies about where his family is at the time. And when his aunt and uncle, who he's staying with, receive a letter from Tim's mom saying, Tim's a liar. I know he's telling you a bunch of things. None of it's really true. He walks out the door and goes to the police department in Wales and confesses to killing his wife and his child. And so it's interesting because he says, I killed them, and they're in the drainage, essentially in the drainage pipe at the front of our building. Go look right now. So the Welsh police, of course, are in a frantic panic to find these two people who they've never heard of. And they call the Notting Hill Police Department, and Notting Hill, you know, brings over some men, and they try to get this drain lid in front of 10 Rillington Place up, which happens to be right in front of John Christie's window, and it will not come up. It's essentially rusted closed, and they cannot for the life of them get it up, and it takes three or four men with kind of crowbars to get this up finally. And the Welsh police officer says, you're full of it. This never happened. You didn't do this. They're not down there. And you couldn't have gotten this lit up if you tried. So what's going on? And so Timothy Evans just never has any real answers. He confessed. He said, I did it. And then as the police are frantically looking for this wife and his little girl, you know, Timothy Evans kind of continues to make up these stories, which is part of his character. It's just what he's always done. He's always been this sort of bombastic, puff out the chest, get in a lot of fights, get drunk. But he loves his little girl, and he can occasionally be a good man and a good friend. So he's an unreliable source. And I think one of the tragedies of this case is while they were searching, you know, they talked to John Christie, who they don't know is a serial killer at the time. He's got two women buried in the backyard, and he and his wife say, listen, this is a really bad guy. He was really mean. He's having affairs. He threatened to kill Burl, and, you know, we wouldn't be surprised if he was involved with this somehow, but we don't know where Burl and Geraldine are. And so not to get too, you know, intricate with the book, I know I've probably already done that already, but you know, the police go searching and they look for Burl and Geraldine, and they manage to walk right past a large piece of evidence that would connect John Christie to being a serial killer, which is when, you know, Christie buried these two women, they, you know, turned into skeletons eventually, and his dog dug in the backyard and dug up a bone from one of the women. It was a femur bone, and he found it. And Christie picked it up and strapped it to a fence, that part of his fence that was falling down. So the police, while looking for two murdered people, walked right past the femur bone of a murder victim from, you know, 7 years earlier. And it was just a real Keystone Cops feeling about this investigation. Everybody was supposed to look in the wash house where the bodies were eventually found, and nobody ended up doing it for several days because there was a miscommunication. And so it became quite a mess. And essentially, just to kind of get down to the end of it, they asked John Christie to testify and be kind of a character witness and to testify against Timothy Evans in his murder trial, because he confessed and then he recanted and then he confessed and then he recanted. And he finally said, John Christie is the one who did it. My neighbor did it. And no one believed him, because John Christie was a respected War Reserve police officer and nobody had any reason to doubt him. So John Christie testified against Timothy Evans. Timothy Evans was convicted and he went to the gallows saying, I didn't do it. John Christie did it. I didn't do it. And he was hanged. And that was the end of that case until bodies turned up at 10 Rillington Place 3 years later. And the public and the press put it together very quickly that this was the same house where Timothy Evans supposedly killed his wife and his little girl and put them in the wash house. And no one believed that the two killers could live at the same address at the same time. So it became a very, very controversial case. And, you know, one of the great things about this case is that he's not just a weirdo serial killer, because believe me, I've read enough about serial killers to be bored by many of them. And John Christie as a person is not, as a serial killer, is not a boring one at all. I thought he was really fascinating. But this case changed British law. It became a case that was one of the major reasons, if not the main reason, that the UK abolished the death penalty in the 1960s, is because of this wrongful conviction.
What we didn't talk about, and maybe just talk about briefly, is that this wrongful conviction is profound, in that you talk about Timothy Evans giving a confession and then four subsequent confessions where he changes his tune. But along the way, he says some things that could be checked out forensically but aren't. So right. Just tell us briefly some of the things that he does say that, again, the Keystone Cops conveniently don't explore.
Well, I think, and you can tell me if I don't cover the stuff that you're thinking of. I think one of the largest issues with forensics was that there was no rape kit done on Burl.
Right.
So, you know, initially and quite literally in the paperwork, in the police interviews that I read, you know, when later on a judge was and he was in charge of an inquiry trying to decide if there was a wrongful execution here, you know, asked the police officers, listen, you know, why didn't you do a rape kit? John Christie's MO, we later find out, is sexual assault and then killing. You know, maybe a rape kit might have shown something. Now, this is, of course, decades before DNA,
sure.
But it would have at least shown, you know, that if there was semen there, it would have at least shown that there was some type of MO connecting Christie. And they didn't do it because the police officer said, the detective told one of the police officers and the pathologist, hey, the husband confessed. No worries. Save your money. We don't need to do it. And so we don't know if there was any kind of sexual assault. There wasn't anything consistent with sexual assault. On the other hand, there were claims that she had tried to have an abortion. So there were some, you know, injuries that were consistent with that, but could have also maybe been consistent with sex assault, but there was no evidence one way or the other. So unfortunately, with circumstantial evidence, some of it's sort of, you know, it cancels itself out. So, you know, we, on the one hand, you've got some injuries that could have been attributed to an abortion. On the other hand, there were injuries that could have been attributed to a sexual assault. And she was pregnant at the time with a little boy. So, you know, all of this creates a big mess. They really dropped the ball. And so I think that was part of it. Later on, John Christie confessed to killing Burl and Geraldine, which I don't even remotely believe his confession. It was so factually ridiculous and inaccurate, it could have never happened, number one. And number two, his attorney asked him to confess to everything under the sun. If JFK had happened during that time period, he would have confessed to shooting JFK. I mean, honestly, he wanted an insanity plea. That's what he wanted. That's the only thing that was going to save his life. And his attorney actually tried to get him to confess to the murder of a little girl when he wasn't even in the area at the time. And he said, no, I don't kill kids. And I think that is another, for me, one of, there were two major points, Dan. I think that if you take, if you say that there's no sexual assault evidence on Burl, that takes away 90% of Christie's motive. With the exception of killing his wife, that was his main MO right there, was a sexual assault and a killing. And so if he didn't sexually assault her, then to me, there's already doubt. One of the things I had was I have a couple of friends who are really, really wonderful pathologists, and they looked at some of the crime scene photos, including, you know, Burl's photo, and it very clearly, the photos very clearly show, and the pathologist report really clearly says that she was punched in the face so hard that her lip touched the top of her nose. It's a big punch. But here's the key, 20 minutes before she was killed. They estimated 20 minutes, and I thought, okay, well, will 1950s pathologists know that? So I sent it to, you know, my friends who are pathologists, and they said, yeah, that looks really consistent with the clotting. And so if you think logically, do you think that Burl Evans is going to let John Christie punch her in the face, which he's never done before to anybody else, punch her in the face, and then 20 minutes later strangle her and kill her? I mean, it just, to me, doesn't make any sense. An abusive husband, I think absolutely, because that's happened before. So it's a mess. This case, Dan, is a mess. I mean, there are so many different pieces of evidence that are confusing and contradictory, but I think that's just one of the things that makes it so fascinating.
We're going to use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor for this program, Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. And as a result, seafood is sourced sustainably. Beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Now, featured upcoming meals, seared chicken and roasted fall vegetables with caper butter pan sauce. I tried myself, 30-minute meal, shrimp and pesto fettuccine with spinach. Absolutely delicious and, of course, very, very easy to do. Gourmet cooking made by myself. And I tried the sweet pepper chicken with bok choy and rice, and this was fantastic. I never would have thought, and I never really think of putting all of these things together, these unique spices and combinations of foods and flavors. It's just amazing. Now, you can choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences, and Blue Apron has several delivery options so you can choose what fits your needs. And there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, and pre-portioned ingredients can be prepared in, now, 30 minutes or less. This week's menu, and get $30 off, $30 off your first order with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's Blue Apron. .com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, you talked about this incredible case of wrongful conviction, but you also spoke about the John Reginald Christie also being very much like what Timothy Evans was labeled as a pathological liar. Let's go back, as you do, to the state of London 5 days later, and what the press, how the press depicted this disaster, and how you say that no one was announcing this except, or no one was concerned, or especially the people who were concerned were the undertakers and not the politicians and not other people you might have thought of. So tell us about what happens after this fog finally lifts in London.
Okay, so the fog, after 5 days, the fog finally lifts and there's blue skies, and London goes back to work. Life goes back to normal, relatively speaking, and there aren't bodies lying in the streets. There aren't people floating in the Thames River. You know, it's not the catastrophe that you would think it would be, because the people who died were people who were prominently already sick and elderly, pensioners who maybe were by themselves, and there were an awful lot of people who died in the hospitals and in the homes, but there was no centralized computer system for hospitals. So there was no real way for doctors to find out how many hospitals, how many intakes there were at each hospital. There was just no coordination. But the undertakers and the morticians and the florists knew something was wrong. And the reason was, very quickly, they started running, within weeks, they started running out of funeral wreaths, and they started running out of plots and coffins, and it became a real problem. And so those were the people who actually alerted the public first. There was nowhere, you know, they started running out of areas to bury people. And so one of the characters in my book is a 13-year-old girl whose father, you know, is dying of from bronchitis. He suffered from bronchitis for years, and the fog really caused him some problems. And, you know, and she talks about in the family's history, as in with many Londoners at the time, when somebody died, they kept him in their front parlor, and they kept the body there for sometimes a week to 2 weeks until a plot was available. And so I think, you know, that this was sort of part of living in a city that is literally shell-shocked from World War II. I mean, you have to think the government's bankrupt. They can't afford to rebuild many of the buildings that have already been bombed. So, you know, Rosemary and her friends are playing hide-and-go-seek in bombed-out buildings with shattered glass and, you know, metal and broken coal cupboards, and it's kind of an incredible scene. And then there's a lot of unemployment and, like I said before, a lot of violence. So London is not an easy city to live in at the time. And so after the fog, there was no public outcry. There was no outcry in Parliament. And, you know, John Reginald Christie, the serial killer, was at the time unknown as a serial killer. He was just another person caught in the fog. So when the December 10th came and the fog had blown away, things went relatively back to normal. Where it became concerning, and I don't think concerning enough, certainly, but where it became very concerning was within several weeks, the Ministry of Health began releasing numbers of how many people died. They had compiled all of these numbers from the hospitals. They had asked for anecdotal evidence, and they started putting together, you know, the numbers. And it was something like 1,200 the first week died, 1,400 the second week died. So it's this, you know, incredibly large numbers, even for a huge city like London. And still, it was back page news. It was incredible because you're talking about a city that had just been bombed 7 years earlier, you know, and was really struggling already. And I think they just wanted to get on with it. So where I became alarmed myself was when I began this book, the research really was on the smog. I didn't know anything about John Reginald Christie. I didn't think about serial killers. I really was exploring the idea of doing this narrative nonfiction book on the Great Smog of 1952. And I needed characters. And I identified one who was a politician for the Labor government named Norman Dodds. And I began searching, probably about 3 or 4 months into this research, I began searching the newspaper archives. And so I looked at the New York Times archives for 1953, so beginning the month after the smog happened. And I looked in the London Times and the Evening Standard and any newspaper essentially that existed in 1952 or 1953. And I was searching for Norman Dodds and his speeches in Parliament. I was searching for any article that talked about the fog. And I was finding very little, but still some information in January of 53 and February of 53. And it all came to a halt in March of 1953, because John Reginald Christie went on the run, and the bodies started coming out of the house, and the police converged, and it all, this house of cards that he had built, all fell down, and all of a sudden the beast of Rillington Place became known, and the public panicked, and the press loved it, of course, and it just sucked away any news that could have been attributed to the fog, any attention that politicians, that the public and the press could have put towards the fog of this disaster, incredible disaster. And it was virtually ignored. And the press was so fixated on Christie. And honestly, why wouldn't they be? Because it's a morbid, right, weird, scary story. And as we know now, I think that 65 years later, we are still, as the public and the press, consumed by strange, weird stories. Anytime a politician tweets something, you know, that seems strange or inappropriate or, you know, attention getting, we are constantly distracted and our attention's turned away from subjects that we really need to pay attention to. And so, Dan, that's exactly what happened. We have a salacious, headline-grabbing story like John Christie, which is newsworthy. I'm not saying it wasn't. Certainly, I would have picked it up if the New York Post was around at the time. I would have absolutely wanted to read about, you know, one body, two body, three bodies being pulled out of the House of Horrors. On the other hand, that left very little space for real stories, and the fog was a very real story. And, you know, finally, these stories collide in Parliament when they're simultaneously debating air pollution alongside the death penalty, because there's now panic that the government has executed the wrong man. So these stories kind of have a climax at the same time, which is in the summer of 1953. And like, what's going to happen with both of these? Are we going to have clean air in the UK? Are we going to continue to have the death penalty? Did they execute the wrong man? And John Christie, while he's in prison, it just virtually every sound the man made while he was in prison was documented. And he finally got the attention he wanted. He had always wanted this kind of attention, and he finally got it.
You chronicle John Christie's entire life, and you talk about, and we don't have a lot of time to go into this, but just to show what he had said, to demonstrate what he had said in these confessions, talks about his grandfather and just the what he experienced seeing his grandfather dead. Could you just go into that, because I think it's very demonstrative?
Yeah, you know, one of his earliest, what he thought was a pivotal turning point for him was when his grandfather died. He was able to go to the funeral, and it was an open casket, and he was, you know, went to the viewing, and he looked and he stared at this body. And, you know, I think it was almost an erotic experience for him. I think he really appreciated, he wasn't scared. And in his confession, he said, I thought I would be, but I wasn't scared of a dead body. I was fascinated with it. And when he killed Ruth First in 1943, who was his first victim, it was spontaneous. I mean, I certainly believe him when he said it wasn't planned. I think it was a spontaneous thing that happened, and he realized that it was a thrill for him. And then he makes these, you know, as any serial killer who wants attention would, he makes these very, you know, ludicrous grand statements and about, you know, the beauty of a corpse and that a living body could never be as beautiful as a corpse, which, yeah, I think mostly was for the benefit of the public. And also, you know, an even more disturbing development that comes out of journalism was checkbook journalism. So there was a reporter who paid for John Christie's defense. And in exchange, right, Christie wrote several very extensive confessions. So that's where this came from. And of course, this is the problem you run into. You pay for somebody's confession, there's the expectation that it's going to be pretty dramatic. And Christie really made it dramatic. I don't know how reliable it is. I mean, it's sort of like H.H. Holmes. How reliable is H.H. Holmes or right, anyone when they confess? But you know, he really didn't have much reason to lie about certain details. And I think that he, you know, like anyone who lived through World War I and World War II, saw death. But I think he saw it certainly as a type of beauty. And it's just when you have a sick mind, it just, you know, you just never know where that sort of fascination, how it's going to manifest itself.
You talk about, too, that he confesses to all kinds of things, and you say it's hard to discern what is truth from fiction in those confessions. But it's amazing to hear some of the things that he does say, because again, it seems like always a put down of potential victims and other people, and there's always something that the killer would not want to admit, but there's other things that they seem to be gleeful about in admission, and that's what it seems to be characterized by Christie as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly think he, as anybody would when you're in the limelight, would pick and choose the details that he wanted exposed. So with Ruth first, his first victim, he called it either having relations or making love. He had never admitted to rape. And he really, the last three women, he said, individually attacked him and forced their way into his house. And certainly he had some pretty incredible claims. He told a police officer who's in my book, Lynn Trevelyan, that his wife was actually an abortionist, and that's why the women were there. But he refused to say that in his confession because he said it would have, done damage to Ethel's reputation. So that is the problem with this case. And as an investigator, 65 years later, I'm certain I feel the same way that the Metropolitan Police must have in 1952 and before in 1949, dealing with both of these men who are just habitual, prolific liars. And, that is the problem, is there are, of course, false confessions are very common. And so it makes it even more difficult to figure out who's right and who's wrong. You have to go on evidence. So, okay, great. Let's see all the circumstantial evidence. And then, of course, we find out that the police didn't do a very good job gathering evidence. And there were a lot of missteps. So then you're left with two executed people. And so this is the way that this lays out, Dan, which I find is so fascinating. So you've got the majority of the public who thought that Timothy Evans was, initially convicted of killing Geraldine. They didn't put him on trial for killing his wife because they thought if they put him on trial for killing Burl, that perhaps the defense could turn Burl into a not very nice woman and there would be empathy and he would get off scot-free, but there's no way he could wiggle around, killing his little girl. So he was put on trial for killing Geraldine, and that's what he was convicted of. So, in the 60s, there was a judge who, Justice Braben, who was told to please go and look at this case again. The family insisted. There was a very famous book written and then later a famous movie called 10 Rillington Place that, professes that Timothy Evans was innocent. And Justice Braben looked at all the evidence and concluded that he thought John Christie killed the little girl, but didn't kill the wife. He thought Timothy Evans killed his own wife and the two worked together. Does that make any sense? That makes no sense to me. But what happened is, because the Judge Braben said, listen, I don't think that he actually killed a little girl, Timothy Evans was exonerated from murdering Geraldine, not from murdering his wife, but he was exonerated officially because he was never convicted of murdering his wife, only of the little girl. So he was, his body was exhumed and he was buried. He was exhumed from a prison graveyard and he was buried in a Catholic graveyard. And, then about 10 years ago, his half-sister filed another claim, and there was a panel in the UK who finally exonerated Evans of all charges, and I believe they were given some sort of monetary stipend, for a wrongful execution. But my goodness, there was just so many different opinions, and I just think it's presumptuous to know anything. I think it's a 50-50 shot. I have no idea. I think most of the evidence points towards Timothy Evans, but I think that there's just no – it's incredible that somebody could make a declarative statement that one of these men did it while the other one didn't,
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, just your theory on why he was so anxious to confess if he wasn't guilty?
Do you mean Timothy Evans?
Yes.
That's the big, that is the problem. That's the sticking point for me. Why did he walk into that Welsh police station and confess? So if he did it, okay, I understand. He walks in, he confesses, then why not tell the police the correct location of the bodies? He didn't. He told them the wrong location. And if he didn't do it, what motivates him to go and confess to begin with? And that's what's confusing. So I don't know. On the other hand, I completely understand why John Christie might have confessed to killing Timothy Evans. To confessing to Burl and Geraldine's murder, because he was trying to get an insanity plea. And he never mentioned before his attorney suggested doing this. He never mentioned their murders. He never mentioned being involved. So I'm apt to believe John Christie over Timothy Evans. I also just cannot. It's hard to picture either one of them killing a little girl, but there's just no motivation for John Christie to kill Geraldine. I just can't. I can't see. I could see Timothy Evans panicking and killing his own child, but I can't see John Christie doing it. There were churches they could have dropped, you know, her off, and she would have been perfectly safe. So I just think there's so many big question marks in the case. And again, it's confusing. So Burl and Geraldine, here's one of the more confusing points. Burl and Geraldine were found in a wash house in the back of the garden. This is a wash house where John Christie kept some of his victims. The key is he kept them in there for very, very brief periods of time, and then he buried them. And Burl and Geraldine were kept in there for several weeks until they were finally discovered. And that's not John Christie's MO. He would have never done that. On the other hand, what are the chances of two killers hiding bodies in the exact same place? And then on the other hand, well, how many places are you going to really hide a body? I mean, this wash house seems like one of the better options. So you can see, Dan, my conundrum when investigating this case. It was very difficult.
What did John Christie have to say about the disappearance of his wife, Ethel?
That was so creepy. So, you know, he killed Ethel a few days after the fog lifted. And he went out into the middle of the fog to resign. I mean, I certainly think he was planning. He had visited prostitutes a couple of days before the fog. And then he went out into the middle of the fog to resign from his job. There was a master plan happening in his head. I think he was done with being married and he was done with Ethel. And so when he finally killed her and he put her under the floorboards of the front parlor and continued to live in the flat, she did not have very many friends. And she had one really good friend who was a neighbor next door. And he kept making excuses to various people. And this neighbor was really the only one who kind of pressed him, because she would see Ethel frequently. And then all of a sudden Ethel's disappeared. And then, of course, he's doing really odd things like, you know, putting down lye that will cover up the smell. And I mean, he's a strange man to begin with. So he said that she was traveling back to go see her sister. And then Ethel's sister would send Christmas cards and Christmas gifts, and Christie would write notes saying that Ethel had arthritis in her hands. He would write notes on, you know, Ethel's behalf, quote unquote, and send him back. So he was really, he was working on a cover up, which to me, of course, means sociopath, not psychopath, because he was actively covering up his crimes. He knew the difference between right and wrong.
Absolutely. You talk about the impact of the deaths from the fog. Again, it's overshadowed by the news of John Christie and the tales in the newspapers, and you say that was a thriving business at that time, and there was a big audience for it. You have some things to say about, in conclusion, to what you, again, parallels to what's happening today, or maybe you can tell us what some of your ideas are about, in conclusion, what this has basically got you to conclude about, again, the environmental disaster and its, again, I guess, ability to happen ever again.
Well, I mean, I think it would be, listen, I mean, the state of China is getting better in India is slowly improving. But I certainly think that there's always a tipping point in countries like that, that are so industrialized and overpopulated, that, you know, with the wrong weather pattern, certainly like this, something like this could happen again. And London today is a horribly polluted city. I mean, they regularly break their pollution, their allotment for pollution levels. And, you know, and certainly in our country, there's always talk about what's happening now with the EPA, who might be taking over the EPA, shutting down coal plants and shutting down coal jobs. And so I certainly think that there are themes from the book that resonate. A wrongful conviction is a very strong theme. Holding a government accountable for, you know, wrongful doings and for promoting a fuel that they know kills. I think that is something that certainly I think people, contemporary readers, can understand. But certainly for me, the biggest red flag is you have two very different killers in this book, and that happens, you know, alongside the same time period. So you've got, you know, a fog that killed 12,000 people, and then you have a serial killer who killed six, maybe eight. And why was one leading the headlines and the other wasn't? Why are six to eight people and their lives more interesting than the lives of 12,000 people? At the time, it was 4,000 people. That was the known number. That's an extraordinary amount of people to have died in just a few months from one air pollution disaster. And so that really, what I think is so interesting is what that says about society and what we value. Just, you know, like look now at the types of stories that get the most hits on the internet. It's certainly not about air pollution. I don't even know if it's about police brutality, about crime, about education. I mean, certainly, you know, we are all aware of the types of stories that get more attention. And it's very frustrating because it's a repetition of what's happened in the past. Is these sort of, you know, really salacious, juicy, meaty stories that just bury the things that the subjects that really, really matter to us, like clean air, clean water, and our health. And so, you know, I want that to be a takeaway that we do need to demand from the press and as part of, you know, members of the public, we have to demand that we want to read the whole array of stories that affect our lives, not just the ones that are going to get the most hits on the internet.
Would you say that the Great London Smog, though, was a cover-up of sorts, rather than just the emphasis was on John Christie, then people really didn't know the actual details? Would you go as far as to say that this was a cover-up of this disaster?
I think so. So one of the things that I discovered was that, you know, the government revealed these numbers for the amount of people dead. And so the numbers were from December 5th until the end of December, 4,000 people died. And the government initially had made the cutoff for the amount of people who died to be in March, which included a total of 12,000 people between December 5th and about the first week of March, 12,000 people died. So that was included in the interim report of a fairly powerful committee that eventually the committee recommended to some pretty sweeping changes of how coal was utilized in London later on. But the government went and demanded that the Ministry of Statistics change that number and roll it back so that the official cutoff time was December 31st, not March, but December, leaving 4,000 being the official total of fog-related deaths. And then on this chart that had once said 12,000 dead from the smog, it said 4,000 dead. And then the last portion of the chart was 8,000 attributed to a influenza epidemic. And that was an epidemic that never happened. It was fabricated by the British government, absolutely. There's no mention of it. There's no, you know, hospital records of it. The World Health Organization never talked about it. 8,000 dead, you know, from a flu in London would have made huge news. And instead, this little chart got buried. And so the number has been left at 4,000 for, 60-something years. So it's pretty incredible that we are now, just in the past decade, finding out the real toll and how many people have still remained sick. And, there have been studies based completely on the Great Smog of 1952, women who were pregnant at the time, little children at the time, and charted how their health has developed since the smog. And the news was not good, as you can imagine. And it's just an extreme example of what could happen, when you have a government that's not willing to take responsibility, for the health of its citizens.
Absolutely. Incredible. Very incredible tale. I want to thank you very much, Kate Winkler-Donson, for coming on and talking about Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the Great London Smog, and the strangling of a city. It's been fascinating. Do you have a Facebook page for the book? And if people might want to give a website, people might want to contact you or find out more about your work.
Sure. So my website is Kate Winkler Dawson. So KateWinklerDawson.com. You can just go there and it shows you all the different ways you can get the book and you read more about it. I have a book trailer there that you can look at, which is like a movie trailer, except it's a book trailer. And some other interviews. And then, yes, on Facebook, you can just look me up, my name, Kate Winkler Dawson, and I have an author's page and I can keep you up to date about what's happening there.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Kate Winkler Dawson. You have a great evening. Thank you very much for this interview. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.